Every year, the Library of Congress announces 25 films which will be preserved and made part of this country's National Film Registry. The films included are deemed artistically or culturally significant and often represent a cross-section of favorite classic titles and A-list directors. But this year's announcement contained a twist. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. This year's National Film Registry announcement included a short film that few had ever seen or even knew existed, called The Kidnapper's Foil. The fact we can see this film at all is thanks in part to the work of Carolyn Frick, Executive Director of the Texas Archive of the Moving Image, and I'm delighted to have Carolyn Frick back on the program today. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're joining us from Austin. First of all, congratulations. Just a few weeks ago, this film that you've championed and filmmaker that you've championed for years was just inducted into the National Film Registry. I can't imagine as a film preservationist anything better.
It's true. I was talking to somebody how I really feel like this is the Academy Award
right.
for film preservation.
And the fact that this is a Texas filmmaker that few have ever heard of that made these short films over 30 or 40 years and the obscurity of it, I think the fact that the Library of Congress has picked a film like this probably brings a lot of film preservationists a lot of pride because it highlights the importance of a very different type of film than we often see chosen for the film registry.
I think that's very true, and I think that that's one of the nice things about the registry this year is that actually to quote Chris Horak, who's the curator at UCLA Film and Television Archive, he feels like this year is the most holistic, the most
right.
representative list that there has been ever in the registry, because it's this really great mix of all kinds of American film production, from those kind of familiar Hollywood stories that are very beloved, like A Christmas Story, to something like Melton Barker, or indeed home movies. For the first time this year, the registry really does embrace in a truly holistic way all of the kinds of films being produced even today.
So put this into perspective. You mentioned A Christmas Story, a favorite Christmas title, but you know also Breakfast at Tiffany's, Anatomy of a Murder. I mean, really big films that we've all seen, as well as some indie films like Tulane Blacktop or The Times of Harvey Milk, a great documentary. Important early cinema like Uncle Tom's Cabin. You know, some things from the silent period. But to have someone of such vernacular background like Melton Barker, who I gather he was from Dallas, the Dallas area?
He was, although I have to say that, you know, I spent a good, I mean, it's so sad, really, to say this out loud, but I have spent a good 10 years of my life trying to track him down, because when I first came across his films, there was virtually nothing about him out there. Literally, he does not appear on the census, even, throughout any period, and from what I've been able to deduce, he was from Dallas originally, but he was truly an itinerant filmmaker, and from that I mean he just spent his life on the road. He traveled from town to town from the 1930s all the way through the 1970s, filming the exact same film over and over again. And I think that's why in some ways the Library of Congress, we were struggling with how to explain this to the public because it's so bizarre. Like, people have been asking questions of, well, what do you mean by the same film? And we literally mean the same film, the same narrative, the same dialogue, verbatim, just with different children from each local community. So all that would change were the kids. So in some cases, like in Childress, Texas, they went back a couple of times, same film, different kids.
And for people of a certain age who recall the Hal Roach comedies, the Our Gang comedies, this sort of paralleled some of that style of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. Very much. I think it was, when I first saw these again, there was absolutely no information. And that is kind of the fun, I think, of film preservation and film archiving, is that you come across cans of film that truly it's like 20th century archaeology, because you open it up and you think, what on earth is this thing? And that was what it was like. There was no information about it. And yet, because of the work that I had done at Warner Brothers, and of course my love for Little Rascals and gang comedies, I immediately noticed that there was this definite sort of reference, this homage to Little Rascals. And he literally says the film stars are local gang. I mean, it's a direct ripoff. The more I dug into this, the more I was able to see that indeed in his own marketing materials, he was very direct. He basically was like, look, your kid's not going to make it in Hollywood. So the closest
this
thing
is
you're
their big
get,
shot.
Oh yeah, this is it. And that's my, in some ways, that's like my favorite part of this because it, instead of, when I talked about this story with people over the last 10 years, people said, oh, he's a charlatan. He's like the music man. He comes in and he promises these things. Quite the opposite. He was like, no. It's not going to happen for you. Okay, so you might as well be in this film because this is your one chance at stardom. So I think he's referencing a lot of classical Hollywood. So the child in the film who gets kidnapped, her name is quote-unquote Betty Davis, purposely misspelled, I'm sure, so that he wouldn't get sued. But the child is kidnapped as Betty Davis, and the gang comes together. And so it is a reference to our gang, but I think when I worked at Warner Brothers Film Preservation, and I worked on a lot of children's short subjects, what's interesting, too, is that it's clearly placed within that context because so many of those short subjects feature children from, let's say, the vaudeville circuit doing performances. And there's always a performance as a part of this with a child MC, which again, very much references to these other kinds of short subjects in addition to our gang.
Was this Melton Barker's primary source of income then? He just traveled and charged people to put their kids in these productions and I presume made some money off the rentals to local theaters.
Yeah, that was. From what I can tell in terms of his financial model, if you want to put it that way, that sounds a little bit more robust. He charged around $10 a child. And during the height of the Depression, that would have been a lot of money. Now, I've had a lot of very eminent film historians come up and really question me on this, but I've seen it. I've seen the receipts, so I know that this is true. And we've been trying to count how many kids we think were in each production. So we think it's somewhere between like 40 and 60 kids, which in essence is not really that much money when you look at how much he probably had to pay for his equipment.
Right.
Because he was doing sync sound at a very early time. He was started to do sync sound not long after the Hollywood studios were doing it, which is pretty significant, I think. And a lot of the technicians in L.A. have noted, wow, this is really unusual that kind of quote-unquote an amateur filmmaker was doing this. But yeah, that was how he made money. From what I can tell, he didn't rent the films. He actually sold them outright to the theater, knowing that a film shot in Austin, Texas, with local children would not have much appeal to folks in Childress. And ironically, I think sometimes when he got really burnt out, he used the same talent show. He just spliced in talent shows from other towns because I found out that all three of the films that still exist from Tennessee all use the same talent show, which I find quite hilarious. So you can imagine the people watching were like, wait, what? Where did this come from?
What's amazing is that you have this chart of the United States on a great website you've put together, meltonbarker.org, that shows little pinpoints of all the places you've been able to pin down that he went to and made these films. And two of those places are El Paso, Texas, and Las Cruces, New Mexico. So somewhere out there, perhaps in someone's attic or basement or closet, is one of these films.
I sure hope so. One of the most important things to me, and one of the things I tried to explain to the National Film Preservation Board about this film is we have a unique opportunity because he made hundreds of these films, and yet we only know of less than, you know, maybe 10 that still exist. So we're really hoping with this film being named to the National Film Registry, we can get the word out and try to say, hey, if you know about a copy of this film, even if it's on VHS at this point, even if it's on a DVD, we'd love, love, love to hear about it because every single week at the Texas Archive of the Moving Image, we get calls saying, my mother was in this film from such and such town, or my father was in this film, or I was in this film. We'd love to see it.
What's amazing, too, looking at the longevity of his career, if I guess you could put career in quotes, but
yeah.
Especially since he specialized in two things that Hollywood really typically dislikes: shooting on location and working with children.
But
pattern held through a lot of transitions in how the industry worked and how people made films, and all the way into the early 70s. Was he one of a number of people doing this, or was he unique in his travels?
Well, that's a really good question. As much as being a Barker fan, I would like to say he was wholly unique. He wasn't. This was actually a pretty widespread phenomena. What I think is unique about Barker was indeed the longevity of his career. Because in my research on this, and I am one of a handful of people who've really tried to dig into this, from what I can tell, he did this for a much longer period. So, for example, there was another Texas filmmaker that I've tracked, a man by the name of Shad Graham, who, from what I understand, was a newsreel cameraman for one of the studios, at one point decided he wanted to just stay in Texas and created his own business. And he created these films called the Texas News Trailers. Well, he did this for maybe a couple of years, and then I think got burnt out. Maybe he couldn't make enough money. You know, Barker's the only one, from what I can tell, who did this for 40 years and literally died on the road doing these films. And for me, as someone who's a historian at heart, what I think is really provocative about these films, I mean, certainly you're not going to watch them for their aesthetics, but I think what's really interesting about them is if we think about what high school students today are being taught about 1968, for example, the images of 1968 in their mind are going to be of civil unrest and it's going to be turmoil, and yet there's Milton Barker out there in rural communities filming the exact same film he was filming in 1935. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of a sweet little, our local town gets together and does fun things. And I think that's what makes it, his contributions in so many ways most important, is because it's really challenging what we think of as kind of popular culture during this period of time.
I'm so delighted that the Library of Congress has recognized this film and your work on that. So congratulations on bringing Milton Barker's career and film The Kidnapper's Foil to the attention of so many. Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Yeah, thank you. And indeed, if anybody knows where a film is, don't hesitate to get in touch with the Texas Archive of the Moving Image.
Fantastic. I've been discussing this year's National Film Registry announcement and its inclusion of Texas filmmaker Milton Barker's short film, The Kidnapper's Foil. The film was saved from obscurity by the efforts of Carolyn Frick and the Texas Archive of the Moving Image, based in Austin, Texas. Milton Barker traveled the country from the late 1930s to the early 1970s, filming essentially the same kidnap-rescue comedy story using an all-local cast of mainly children. Barker made two of these films in El Paso in 1937 and 1949, and one in Las Cruces, New Mexico in 1951. Most of his 35mm versions no longer exist. To learn more about Milton Barker, his itinerant filmmaking, and watch his film, The Kidnapper's Foil, log on to MiltonBarker.org. And that's Milton, M-E-L-T-O-N. On Films producer is Norma Martinez. An archive of past programs is available on this station's website at ktep.org. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.